We were so at Hot
Things, huh? Hey, hang on one sec. All right, so we're back recording, and let me just say for the record, it is January 6th, 2021, and we're resuming our conversation in session three, Dr. DeAngelis and I. So thank you again. Thank you for rescheduling.
My pleasure.
So, when we ended up last time, you had just finished talking about that problematic interview session and what then drew you back and decide to take a position at Hopkins. So tell me about being a new faculty member and what were your impressions
at Hopkins?
Yeah, coming back to the institution and really for the situation for women there.
Well, it's interesting. There weren't very many women leaders. But there were some wonderful women, especially in pediatrics and a couple in internal medicine, almost none in surgery or anything else. But there were probably, I can't remember exactly, maybe a dozen to 15 professors. But I went there first as an associate professor.
Let me ask you, did the women who were on faculty, did you guys think of yourself as a group? Did you kind of support?
No.
Them? Oh, wow.
No,
okay.
There was nothing like that in 1978 when I went back. Nothing like that. And so, in pediatrics, there were a fair number of women. And I was really busy because I was setting up something from scratch. And you remember Hopkins is a subspecialty place. To them, general pediatrics and academic general pediatrics was, what is that? And it was interesting because, the faculty, even in peds who were, they were my former teachers, really. The leaders, and they're very respectful, except as one of them said to me, look, he said, I don't understand what you're trying to do, but as long as you don't take up space or any of our resources, go ahead.
What was your reaction to that?
I like the man, and I just figured his head was in the 50s. That was fine with me. I remembered what a good teacher he was and what a good doctor he was. So I didn't, I choose your battles. And that wasn't one I was going to do. I wasn't going to disrespect him, not at that point. Mm-hmm. And so I just set my mind to writing grants and setting up this program. And it was interesting because if you remember the things that I wanted was I wanted one intern a month. That meant I have 12 of the 18, okay? And that they'd stay 1 month with me and that we would then start a program where they would pick up patients from the clinic or from the emergency room. And and then they'd start their own panel of patients, which was unheard of. Okay. You follow?
Why was that kind of a controversial thing? What was new about that?
Well, because there was inpatient and outpatient, and there was no following a panel of patients then. I mean, this is 1978. Okay. And we were one of the earlier programs that had such a program like that and among the major medical schools, medical institutions. So
I'm sorry to keep interrupting you, but at the time, what did you foresee as the advantage for having panels of patients like that?
Well, first of all, if you don't follow patients, how are you going to know if you're a pediatrician, you should be following patients. You should follow them over time and you know about them, so you don't have to start from scratch with every visit. Mm-hmm. And some of these people were going to go into private practice. As it turned out, some of them did. I mean, most Hopkins residents did subspecialty training, and but they had their own panel of patients, but in their subspecialties. But they're pediatricians, so you have to know basically what do these kids need. So, and the other advantage was you learned growth and development and some of the behavioral issues from the various ages, and you picked up social problems and stuff like that. And because we, the emergency room, there was no faculty member assigned to the emergency room. It was the outpatient chief resident. And if they needed a physician's input, they'd call a specialist down, you know? And so after a while, because we were open in the morning from, we started our clinics at 8 and we went to 4 or 5 o'clock. And the after a while, it was interesting to see that when the residents came through our clinic and they saw what we taught them, because if there was a downtime, or even like at lunch when there was no patient schedule, I had probably 1,000 slides. You got to remember, this is 1978, of every kind of rash or problem, and we'd have fun. They'd be eating lunch. I'd be teaching them, showing them different rashes and or different types of problems, and I'd present the problem to them, and we'd learn that way from slides. And word got around, hey, this is pretty good stuff. Mm-hmm. And the other thing was, when any patient from our clinic was admitted, I was the attending. And I went, I can remember this one kid was admitted. It was followed by one of the residents, which meant I was the attending. And the resident called me and said, you know, I think this kid has a high appendix, but I'm not sure. But we're going, I think he needs to be admitted. And so we're going to admit him, but the chief resident won't call the attending and won't call the surgeon until the morning. And this was like 2 a.m. And I said, wait a minute. And I got in my car and I drove in and I went to the unit and I said, I want the surgical resident now. And the resident came down and I said, look, I examined the kid and it was clear the kid had a hot appendix. It was retrocecal, and there's a special way you examine the kid to find that out. And I said to him, this child has a hot appendix and I want him in the OR now. And the guy said, well, wait a minute, this is a clinic patient. I said, this patient is followed in our clinic. He is my private patient. I'm a faculty member. And where is your faculty member? He said, well, I'm not going to call him until morning. I said, look, I'm a faculty member. I'm here. I said, either you call your surgeon or I'm going to pick up the phone and call him. Of course, I knew who the surgeon was. And he said, you're the attending? You're on the faculty? I said, yes, I am. I said, do you want me to call Dr. So-and-so? He says, well, no, ma'am, I'll call him. He called him and he told him who I was and that. The surgeon came in and the kid did have a hot appendix. He was fine. But the word got around then. Hey, when you admit a patient from there, you know, Dr. D, or after a year, I got some other people who who joined the faculty with me. I got some money from grants and stuff. And the word got around. This is serious business. Mm-hmm. And we didn't just do outpatient. We did general pediatrics. Our patient was admitted. We were the attending. Mm-hmm.
And, so you really changed the culture at that point.
Absolutely.
Yeah, that's amazing.
Totally. Yeah. General academic pediatrics, which today is one of the biggest, when I went to the dean's office in 1990, we were bringing in more grants, more money in grants than any other division.
Wow.
And I mean, we had just taken over because after a while, we needed more space. And so I convinced them, I said, look, during the day on the whole first floor, which was all emergency room, I said, you guys don't see that many patients during the day. You don't need the whole floor. You're only using half. Give us this half. You take that half. We'll be gone by 5 o'clock. That's when you really start. I said, and in return, I will be the faculty member for you. I'll come over. And when I taught at, at noon or downtime, I had my slides. So they were learning. Mm-hmm. And gradually, we took over the emergency room.
Wow.
Then what happened was I wanted the kids who were admitted at night came in through the main ER. And I said, this is just wrong. This is just absolutely wrong. I said, we need to have the coverage at night from our ER for kids. Mm-hmm. And so what I did was I invited the man in charge of that and his wife to dinner on a Saturday night. And after dinner, I said to him, I said, Ed, I would like to show you something at the hospital. It is all right if Jim takes your wife, Mary, home. And she didn't mind. She said, that's fine. And he said, yeah, okay, I'll go. I said, okay, come on. I said, I'll drive you home or I'll drive you back to my place and you can drive home because Jim will. Okay. So I took him into the adult ER. Now you got to understand what the main ER was at night on a Saturday night. And it was now about 10 o'clock. It's like the East Baltimore Rod and Gun Club.
Yeah,
okay.
Yeah.
and we walked in and it was chaos. Like it was, one person was drunk and had vomited on the floor. And there was a kid brought in over in the corner and the kid was hysterical. And I said, Ed, that kid over there could be your grandson. Would you want your grandson to be that kid in this ER, in this, and that kid is sick? He said, all right. Mm-hmm. And so we arranged that we would see all the emergency room would come to us, not downstairs.
So and how did the resourcing work with that? Because I can imagine there were a lot of logistics to work out.
I'm sorry, I lost you there for a while.
Yeah, we're getting a little
how
bit
did
of
the
interruption.
What?
How did the resourcing work for that? Because I imagine that would be a real concern.
No, it wasn't. We had people covering. It's just that, we weren't seeing the ones brought into the ER. We were seeing kids who were walk-ins and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. It wasn't costing anybody anything. It was just reutilization of space and an understanding that kids are not adults.
Right, right.
And they need their own environment.
Did you eventually have like a formal auxiliary pediatric ER?
Yeah.
That was eventually.
It was an auxiliary. It was a pediatric ER.
Yeah. Okay.
And I pretty much took it over.
Wow. That's amazing. And so what year was that happened?
Oh, that was about, let's see, there was 78. That was probably 79, 80.
Okay. Interesting.
Something like 79 or 80. Yeah. And then, you know, we had these kids. I had a program. I had money for residents, for fellows rather. And one of the fellows got interested in these babies that were being born from HIV positive mothers. And we started a clinic called the Intensive Primary Care for these babies, which developed into its own program. And the person, when she graduated from the residency, from the fellowship, excuse me, with me, I hired her on the faculty. We got enough money and she ran that clinic, and she just retired this year.
So how was Hopkins? Because I mean, in conversations I've had with people who've, you know, were professionals during that time, have talked about, you know, the fear about treating AIDS patients, you know, all of that. What was Hopkins like at that time for it?
Well, in pediatrics, that wasn't an issue for us. We knew to be careful. We knew to be careful with needles. We knew to be careful with gloves and stuff like that.
So you didn't have faculty members refusing to treat?
No, not in pediatrics.
Wow, that's great. That's amazing.
And then, you know, there were other things. I went with my husband, who's a psychiatrist. I went to a Christmas party at the home of the woman who ran the college health service. Well, she was having trouble. She said, you know, she's a psychiatrist. And she said she was having trouble finding people who would cover the college health service. And I said, how about if I take over? You're paying them. How about paying me one faculty person and I'll take over there? And so we took over the college health service.
Wow. Yeah.
Which was fine. And it was just added it to our adolescent. We started the day. We had the young adults. We had the infants and kids, and then we had the adults. So I said, okay, we have an adult clinic, and I'm sorry, adolescent clinic, and we had the other clinic. And then we were seeing young kids, babies themselves, 14 and 15-year-olds who were pregnant. We had a kid come in, she was 13 or 14, came in with abdominal pain. I examined her, she was pregnant. She had no clue. Her grandmother took her in. In fact, she was holding a doll. Mm. So anyway, I talked to one of the OB-GYN women and said to her, look, you're delivering these mothers. And she said, yeah, we have a heck of a time with them because they won't come back to the clinic. I can't get them to take the, you know, give them pills and whatever she did. And I said, well, how about we start a mother-child clinic, a mother-infant clinic? They'll take their babies in. But if they come in with the babies, we'll see the baby. You can see the mother for the first post delivery. Then we could take over. They're teenagers. That's what we'll do. And so we started a teenage mother, a mother child clinic. I mean, we just kept, you see a need. So you
yeah.
see. So,
well,
we
so have, it's really comprehensive care. I mean, it's really interesting. I mean, just out of curiosity, what percentage of those, you know, young girls who were getting pregnant, was it a result of some kind of sexual abuse in the family.
Well, most of it wasn't that. Most of it was just, and a lot of them got the recidivism rate, the repeat pregnancies.
Yeah.
What we did when we started this mother-child clinic, we cut the number of repeat clinics by 50%.
Wow.
Just because we got the mothers to come in to take the pills, we examined them. We would do anything. I would not put in an IUD because I'm Catholic and I wouldn't put in an IUD. But somebody with the OB-GYN would do that. It was interesting that by just having a comprehensive, ongoing continuity of care, you could cut out all kinds of things. And we had early intervention, early diagnosis of kids with diabetes, early diagnosis of a lot of stuff, preventive stuff. The vaccinations were up to date. And I mean, after the first year, when we went into the second year, all 18 of the incoming interns wanted to have their month with us. And the second year residents, the 6 of them who had not had the rotation with us insisted they would use their one elective month to be with us.
Wow.
So the second year we had 18 and 6, we had 24. We had two a month.
Wow, that's amazing. Yeah.
And you know, I just said, look, you'll come because you know this is worthwhile and you'll learn a lot.
Mm-hmm. Now I have I want to talk more about how that evolved and kind of changed the culture at Hopkins, but I don't want to neglect the fact that in 1979 you also got married.
Yep.
And so I want
the only time I ever took time away from the clinic was the 2 weeks that I went on my honeymoon and I had someone else take over. And that was 1979. And by then I had hired the two people who came with me from Wisconsin. One came as a fellow because I had money for a fellow and I had money for a faculty. So one was the faculty and one was the fellow. And so they took over the clinic the 2 weeks I was away. That was it. But
that's
the
cool.
First year, I was not away at all.
Yeah. Now tell me your husband's name and tell me your husband.
Is Jim Harris. James Harris.
And
tell you what?
And tell me how did marriage and family affect your career? How did that change things?
Wonderful. Because then what happened was we'd get called in the middle of the night. And if with some of the patients, they'd ask for we lived on Tuscany Road and they'd call it a total Tuscany consult because you know, they called 2 a.m. to get me and my husband. Almost all the calls came to me, but there were some times when I said, look, this is a behavioral thing. Let's let the mom talk to Jim. So it was funny. We were very happy. It just made it easier for both of us.
Mm-hmm. That's very cool.
It was very nice.
The marriage family. Yeah,
I wish every woman could find a man like my Jim. Mm-hmm. We waited a while. I mean, we weren't young when we were married, but it's wonderful. I mean, every morning now we even say, you know how lucky we are. you know.
Well, especially people locked down. It's nice to like the person you're locked down with, right?
Oh, we not only like, we got to like each other a lot more.
That's cool. Yeah, for sure.
Yeah, we take care of each other. It's nice.
That's great. Now, what advice to women now would you provide when women are, you know, struggling with issues of family and whether to marry or not marry?
Well, look, I say there's no reason why you shouldn't marry, and there's no reason why you shouldn't have children. I mean, as you say, what's the right time? You decide. For some people, you should have a baby right away, especially if you're older when you get married. You should try and have a child right away. And you just work around it, you know. And now it's getting easier because there are things like shared residencies. There are other things like half-time residencies where you only work half-time, but you work 2 years to get 1 year credit. There's all kinds of things like that. And a lot of, you know, women, they work up until the time when they deliver. We had one woman who came into the residency when I was a resident. I was a senior resident, and she came in as a first year, and she had just delivered. It was very, very interesting because he's now, he's a PhD, and I had his first birthday party and I used to take turns covering her so she could go home to breastfeed. You know, you just, if you really respect each other and you try to help each other, you can work out anything.
So you had a pretty good team.
I mean, I saw...
I had
wonderful.
Yeah, and so they, because I, you know, I think it's hard when you have to rely on institutional policies to dictate what people do, but the people themselves are kind of unwilling to do it.
Yeah, well, we sort of made our own policies because nobody paid any attention to us until they realized, oh my God, what's going on there?
Yeah. So when did that happen? When you realize, oh, what's going on there?
It just gradually, that's the way you want it. You know, you want it that way. And I remember that's the time when the Johns Hopkins health system was starting up. And what they would do is they would go around and they'd pay people to enroll patients. Well, they'd go into a house and they would enroll, if there were like two children, they'd enroll the healthy one. But the one who had problems, they'd leave to show up at our place, you know, which, you know, we were happy to do it. But then what they would do, instead of having, you know, coverage at night, they just send them to us. And so I started billing them. And when they got up to the point where they owed us $1 million, I said, we're not going to take you anymore. If the patient came in and it was an emergency, we would never turn them away. So what did I start to do? I personally triaged when a patient from the health system came in and it wasn't an emergency. We triaged them back to see their primary care person at the health system in the morning. Well, Dr. Heisel, who was the president of the hospital, had a fit. And, you know, he and I got into a real argument. And, you know, fortunately, at that point, I just stuck to my guns and said, you're not going to use us. And then you look real good because you're saving money, and then you're going to turn around and you're going to tell me that we're losing money and therefore we can't have resources. I said, I won't do that. I will fight you every inch of the way. And, I'm fighting with the president of the hospital. But fortunately, it worked out. It was fine. We worked it out. But, you can't back down on something that you know is right. And you can't let people walk all over you. You never put a patient at risk, ever. But there are limitations to what you will accept.
So how did this track record help you expand or do more with pediatrics?
Well, after a while, I'd been there about 4 or 5 years, and about 4 years, I think it was 1982, I guess it was. I was asked if I would be willing to take over being the residency director, because the residents would come to me with all kinds of things. And the residency director was leaving and going to another institution. And so I said, okay, but I want to be paid the same rate as him. I found my salary went up about 25%. And, Dr. Littlefield agreed. He said, yes, of course, that's fair. But when you're residency director, you get a lot more say in what's going on. And I moved my main office up in the same place as the chair of the department. And then I asked if I would be the deputy chair of the department. And the whole thing started to evolve. And the next thing I know, in 1990, I was asked to come over and be the dean, came in as the associate dean and then became the vice dean. And it just evolved. I mean, I didn't set out to do any of that stuff. I just sort of let the wind take me. Did you ever wonder, where does the wind come from and where does it go?
Well, it's funny you're saying that because we're just having a wicked windstorm here. Right? The noise you heard was a scream blowing out of the window.
Oh, dear. It's okay. Well, it's pretty windy here. I went for my walk this morning. It was pretty windy and cold.
It feels good, but, it's crazy. Well, I was going to ask you, so you said in each of these instances where you moved up, you had kind of more say. What were some of the things that you were able to set in place during that time that you felt, you look back on that and you feel it really made a difference in Hopkins?
Well, the main thing was what I was able to do with women, because I was, before I came to the dean's office, Oski was then the new pediatric chair, and the faculty council was really the chairs of every department, but internal medicine and pediatrics each had two representatives because we had such large faculty. Faculty numbers. And so I was the only woman, except for the secretary. And it was interesting because about 1988 or 89, Dick Ross, called me to his office one day, and he said, look, I've been told by the president of the university that the School of Public Health people did a study, and our women are way underpaid. And he said, I don't know that that's true, but I'm supposed to fix it. And I said, where's their study? He said, well, yeah. He said, here's the study that was done. And I quickly looked through it and I said, well, this study is flawed. I said, it was done by someone who doesn't understand the School of Medicine. I said, because they just considered, they didn't make any allowances for time in rank. I mean, obviously, if you've been a professor for a long time, your salary's higher. And if you're a professor, you make more than an assistant professor or an associate professor. And there were more men professors than there were women. And there were more men in the higher ranks who were higher paid. There were more men who were surgeons. I said, that none of this makes any sense. I said, but I'm going to tell you. He said, well, could you set up the study and do it? I said, I can. I said, but I said, while their methodology is not right, I'm pretty sure that we're going to come out with the same answer, that women aren't paid this equitably with men. I said, so I will only do it. I need three things. One, I need access to everybody's salary. And now you know I would never divulge any of that. I said, the second thing is you have to know that if we find a discrepancy, will you tell me that you will fix it? And he said, okay, those two things are fine with me. I said, okay. I said, the third thing is I want to meet with every department chair because I'm going to set up this study. But in order to have the chairs of all the departments accept it, I want to go meet with each one of them individually, show them the study and say, what am I missing? He said, okay. So he did that. I met with all the chairs separately. Almost no one had any major anything to change the study. So I did the study. I had access to everybody's salary. And sure enough, women were not paid equitably with men. The other thing I discovered, and I wanted to see at the same time, was ranks. Women were not promoted anywhere near at the same rate as men. So the first and other thing I said is I will repeat this every year. I will look at salaries every year to make sure that we maintain this equitability. I actually found there was one man who wasn't paid equitably. So we fixed that salary too. And it took like 2 years to make the balance right. And it cost the dean about $2 million. But he kept his word. He was a wonderful man. And I saw this problem with rank. So I decided that we would form a women's group. And so I got all the women professors because when I became a professor, which was a year later, I got all the women professors and what we agreed to do was each of us would take two women, two associate professor women and mentor them. Also that I said I would conduct meetings that the faculty, the women faculty can attend and we can talk about how do you get promoted? What do you need to do? And so we set up that program and we were able to make gigantic changes. I mean, at that point, I think, as I said, there were 15 or 20 of us. Now I think we're at just under 300.
Wow. Now I was scanning your CV to look for dates, but I'm not finding them as quickly as I should. So when did, were you asked to undertake this study? What was,
It was about 1988 or 89, something like that. And then,
and then, you started the women's group what year?
Probably the year, it's probably, probably 1990, okay. 89, 90, something like that.
Mm-hmm. And so what evolved from all of that? I mean, you said you were able to make really big changes. What was the
record? Well, if you look now, I mean, there's, you know, in 1990, I was asked, I was going to leave and I was going to take a job in Texas as a dean. And to join a Jack, what's his name? Jack, I'm blocking on his name now, but he was the vice chancellor there. It was at Galveston, I think.
Oh, UTMB. Anyway,
yeah. No, anyone, and I was going to go there to be the dean. Mm-hmm. But what happened was there was a new dean, and that's Mike Johns, became the new dean. And I went over, I made an appointment to see him to tell him I was leaving. He had asked his secretary to make an appointment because he wanted to ask me to come over and be the associate dean. Mm-hmm. Well, we both met, and I said, well, I call this meeting. And he said, no, I call this meeting. We said, wait a minute. And his secretary called her, and she's a wonderful administrative assistant, Kathy Long. And she said, well, you both wanted to meet, so we have one meeting. Anyway, I said I'd have to think about it. I said, you know, I'm not sure I want to be an associate dean. Here, and, you know, I could be a dean there, and let me think about it. So it was the weekend. This was a Friday. So Saturday morning, I'm sitting working on something, and my husband comes out on the, we had a patio. I was sitting there, and he has the phone in his hand, and he says, Kathy, President Richardson, who was relatively new president, wants to talk to you. I said, get out of here. Somebody's playing a joke. He said, well, I don't know. He said, take the phone. So I took the phone. I said, okay, who is this playing a joke? He said, well, he said, this is you know, Dick Richardson. I said, Dr. Richardson? He said, yes. He said, I said, this is no joke. He said, no, no. He said, I wanted to talk to you. And I said, sure, sir, about what? And he said, well, I think it's really important for you to take this position as associate dean of academic affairs. And I said, but why? He said, how many strong women leadership people do we have? And I said, well, he said, right now, if I were to ask anybody, who's the strongest woman leader now, faculty member? He said, it's you. Mm-hmm. He said, and so it's important for us to have you. He said, I know. He said, look, I know you've been offered other deanships, and you know you will continue to be offered deanships. He said, so you could leave. He said, I want you to really think about this. Just think about it. Even if you're only there for 2 or 3 years, he said, you'll make a big difference, and then you can go and be dean someplace. So I said, oh, well, okay. I said, yeah, I'll think about it, but I couldn't believe he called me. But I figured, okay, I mean, if he thinks that's important, then maybe it is.
And so what went through your head as you were kind of thinking that over, you know?
Well, I loved Hopkins. I've always loved Hopkins. And I just thought I was stuck where I was. you know, I couldn't go anymore in PEDS. I had turned down chairs, and I didn't want to be a chair of a department. I mean, I was beyond that. I knew that. So I thought, I didn't think there was anything else for me. You know, I couldn't go any further. I had done as much as I could. And then when he called, I thought, well, you love this place. Jim won't have to move and start all over. He had, you know, he was wonderful. So I said, okay. And I like Mike Johns. He was on the faculty. He was the chair of otolaryngology, head and neck surgery. So I went over and I took on. And then I became the vice dean. And after 3 months, I was asked if I would also take over and be the vice dean of faculty. Mm-hmm. Because Mo Margolis, he hated it, and faculty were coming to me anyway. Mm-hmm. And it's interesting that I'd been in the dean's office probably 4 or 5 weeks. And one of the things is I'm a Eucharistic minister, so I used to go to Mass at 7 o'clock every morning, and at 7:30 I'd go over to, you know, Mass is over, and I'd go over to my office. Well, the chapel is right across the hallway from the cafeteria. And so people knew that if they wanted to talk to me, all they'd have to do is wait about 7:30 and ask to walk with me over to my office across the street. And so many, many mornings I'd have somebody do that. Well, one morning, one of the faculty, a guy, told me that about this faculty member who was a hotshot in the hospital, brought in a lot of money, but that he was not very nice with women. And he was... he had Roman fingers, and you know what I mean. And I said, oh, my goodness. I said, just have one of these women come and talk to me. And he said, well, they're afraid to. I said, well, I can't do anything unless someone comes and makes a complaint. He said, all right, let me see what I can do. Well, nothing happened for a couple of days. And then another gentleman came and told me the same thing. And I said, look, I said, this is driving me crazy because this should not be tolerated. I don't care if the guy brings in $1 million a day. Who cares? That will not be tolerated here. I said, but I can't do anything without an official complaint. I said, look, can't you guys find a woman, a professor, a woman professor, or it's the senior woman who will come and make the complaint to me, somebody who knows me, and they know they can trust me. I would never break the confidence of anybody, and if I can't do anything about it, I'm certainly not going to compromise anybody. And that's what happened. One of the senior women took one of the junior women who had been, you know, very sexually harassed. And we got rid of the guy.
Wow. Wow.
10 days later, he was out. I talked to Mike Johns about it, the dean, and he said, take care of him.
Wow.
He had a daughter who was in medical school then.
Yeah.
And he's a decent man. He would never tolerate that. So I had the guy. I gave him a chance to resign. I said,
What effect did that have?
It was interesting because then, I mean, these two guys and a number of people said, well, you sure passed that test. We actually had money going on whether or not you'd be able to do anything.
Wow.
I said, well, I hope Bet Against Me lost a lot of money. They did. You know, I bet a Coke or something.
Sure.
Yeah. But look, I mean, you have to stand by what you believe in. Mm-hmm. And you cannot make promises and you cannot ask people to do things if you're not going to follow through.
That changed the climate. I mean, to demonstrate that there were consequences, even for a very high profile person.
Oh, you bet. You bet. Now, going forward, there was a claim made against another faculty member who was a very important guy. But the complaint was made against them. And so I said I would investigate it. As it turned out, I talked to the woman and it was not a legitimate complaint. But what happened was she had a very jealous husband, and the person who was accused of harassing her asked her to dance. They were at a faculty thing, people around, and everybody was dancing with everybody. And her husband went crazy. And so she lied to him. And then he lodged the complaint. So it works both ways.
Yeah, absolutely. And you have to be.
And she was okay because I said to her, look, do you understand that you will ruin a person's career? I mean, to you, you know, he didn't do it. She said, well, I never said anything about rape or anything. I said, you don't understand sexual harassment. His career is finished. So anyway, I got her and her husband together and we talked about the thing and everything was okay.
Mm-hmm. So did the institution, you know, backed you up with that first faculty member, you know, did that change like sexual harassment training or other kinds of policies? What happened?
I think over the years, if you see now, it's not tolerated, period. It's not tolerated. You can't get away with that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. I mean, even another thing, the gay lesbians, okay? I was in my office. I'd been the vice dean for, I guess I was still senior associate dean at that point. And I got a call one day from someone who asked if he could come and meet with me with some people. And he said, but you see, my office was on the first floor. So if you walked into the Ross building, I opened up the windows and everything because I loved, you know, and I could see people going by and that. And he said, but will you close the curtains? And can we meet very early? And I said, sure. I said, how many? He said, there'll be like six of us. I said, okay. So I said, we'll meet at 7. Is that all right? I said, I will miss mass. Okay. He said, well, that would be great. Okay. So they come in. I knew what it was. As soon as I saw them, well, I knew what it was. But I had some muffins and coffee. And so we sat down and I said, okay, gentlemen. I said, before we start, I said, I want to tell you, I didn't know you guys were bigots. And they looked at me and they said, what? I said, where are the lesbians? Mm-hmm. And the five of them just looked at the one guy who set up the meeting. And he said, I told you she's okay.
That's good.
So we met, we talked, and we set up a gay and lesbian day. This was way back now, before it was, you know, the fancy titles and everything now.
What year was that?
1990, 91, maybe 92. Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. Yeah. So we had a gay and lesbian day where we had presentations and that. And that young faculty member, became the associate dean for students. He just retired.
Oh, wow. That's interesting. Yeah.
Yeah. It's nice.
Yeah, for sure.
Yeah.
Making possibilities.
I mean, you know, you can, it's very interesting to me how it doesn't take a lot. It just takes someone to take the lead. And you know, so what do you, I mean, there are times when people would be threatening and stuff like that. And I said, fire me, go ahead, fire me. I can always work as a pediatrician. I could get a lot of jobs.
What were the
fire me?
They were, what were some things
no
they
would.
What were things that they were threatening you about? You know, what were those kind of lightning?
Oh, well, no. I mean, verbally, I think to myself, what are you going to do? Fire me?
Oh, okay. I see what you're saying. Yeah. Because I mean, controversial things.
You know, I mean, you asked me to be in this position. I didn't ask you.
Mm-hmm.
And if I see something wrong, if I can do something about it, I will, no matter what level I'm at.
Now, when you were kind of deciding that you'd gone as far as you could go at Hopkins, you know, back in the 80s and everything, and, you know, were thinking about leaving the institution, was it because your interests were kind of shifting focus to more of these equity issues, kind of more policy and...
Well, no.
Again, answer how you'd like about that. You know, when did that become a primary focus for you?
Well, I don't think it ever did. It's not primary focus. It's just a focus.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, when it was one of the things that needed to be taken care of. I mean, and it's the story of in 1999. I'd been in the dean's office for 10 years at that point. I was the vice dean and everything was settled and we had a lot of good stuff going. And that's when I decided, you know, maybe now I'll take the deanship.
Mm-hmm.
And I certainly I've been offered deanships all the time, but I decided to take one. And I went to a meeting. At that point, I was the editor of what's now JAMA Pediatrics.
Mm-hmm.
And so we had a meeting because they had fired the editor-in-chief of JAMA.
Mm-hmm.
And so we had a meeting. Our annual meeting, and we were all there, and they were talking about, they set up a search committee, and they wanted, they were looking, you know, they were, the search committee was to name a new editor, and so we're sitting around, and it was just the executive committee of the board, which was all the editors of all the different, there was JAMA, and there were, I think at that point, I don't know, 8 or 9 specialty archives, we called them then. And so we said, look, I mean, what do you have to do is you can't have the editor reporting to the AMA board, because the board members are all private practitioners. They don't know a P wave from a P value. They don't know about research. And so there has to be a journal oversight committee of some kind. And, but that, without that, who's going to take the job as editor? You'd have to be a fool, because all you're doing is you're sitting under the thumbs of people who don't know what they're talking about. And there has to be editorial freedom, or you don't have a real journal. So we're sitting around and we're talking, and that was the proposal. So at the meeting, the chair of the search committee said that he had proposed that and that the board refused to do it. So I said, okay. I mean, they're all guys, okay, me as usual. I said, I'll tell you what. I move that if the board doesn't do this, we all resign. Let them find, oh, it was 11. There were 10 of them. Let them find 11 editors. Now, you got to understand that JAMA and the Archives journals were cash cows for the AMA. Mm-hmm. They brought in a lot of money, okay? And everybody said, good idea. All in favor? Aye. Good. Okay. I said, well, the meeting's over. We got up. We walked out. Now, I was followed out by the then new vice. He was the vice chairman of, or the vice president, excuse me, of business affairs at the AMA. He was the guy who had just retired from working for United Airlines. He was the one who developed e-ticketing. I mean, he was just a spectacular guy and a really nice guy. So he follows me out and he says, Dr. DeAngelis, you can't do that. And I said, we just did. I said, you don't understand. I said, we're editors. We don't make any money with this kind of stuff. I said, we get paid what, $10,000 a year, and we divide it up among people who assist us. I said, at the end of the year, if I get $1,000 or so, I said, I don't do this for money. It's ridiculous. This is not why we do it. We do it because we believe in editorial freedom and that what we put out is the truth. And we will not be told by people who have no say in any of this kind of stuff, what we can and can't publish. It's simple. He said, oh my goodness. So we left. This was a Wednesday. On Thursday, we all got an email. All the editors got an email from the chair of the search committee, who was editor of Neurology, JAMA, Archives of Neurology. And he said, the board decided that we can have a journal oversight committee. Oh, yay. Happy. Everybody's happy. Friday, I get a phone call from the chair of the search committee. He says, Kathy, we want you to be the new editor. I said, are you out of your mind? I don't want to be an editor. I'm going to be a dean. They said, no. Who else is going to make this happen? I said, look, guys, I don't want to be. I said, part-time, for PZ, I could do that. That's fun. But I'm going to go and be a dean. He said, look, promise me you'll think about it over the weekend and call me Monday. I said, well, okay, out of respect for you, I'll do that. So Saturday, my husband and I walk around. There's a reservoir around just north of Baltimore City. So we're walking around and we get about halfway there. And my husband says, how many deans are there in the United States? I said, I think it was 125. He says, and how many editors of JAMA are there? I said, one. He said, where do you think you can have the most effect and most influence on Edison? I called him a bad name. And so Monday morning, I called and said, okay, I'll go and I'll talk to the president and the CEO, the chief executive officer of the AMA. And the rest is history.
Yeah. Well,
who knows?
I know. Well, listen, we've been recording for about an hour. Why don't we leave it there? We always seem to do that. We like get an hour and then we're like in the next part of the story. So set up a time for next week. And
okay, now next week I'm going to be in Baltimore, so that doesn't matter. Okay. Let's see. Got my calendar.
Tuesday's probably a good day.
Tuesday,
like 2 o'clock or
three o'clock my time on the 12th.
3 o'clock on the 12th, yeah. And I'll double check by
calendar. Let me check here. Let me see the 12th. Let me see. JC Wozowski, Zoom, 3 to 4, add. Yep, I got you in.
Excellent, great. I'll make a note for my okay. Hey, terrific. Well, thanks so much.
All right.
Exciting story.
Thank you. I hope your arm, does heat help it?
Yeah, it does a little. I mean, it's amazing. I've never had this reaction to a vaccine before. So, you know, I hope it's...
Hey, you know, you must have got a good vaccine because it's
I figure it's doing its job.
Yeah, there you go.
All right. Well,
do you know which one you got? Did you get the Pfizer?
Got the Pfizer, yeah. They're doing both Moderna and Pfizer right now, but I got the Pfizer vaccine. Yeah.
Okay, wonderful. You take care now.
You too. Looking forward to talking to you next week.
Right. Okay, bye-bye.
DeAngelis.